Thank you for downloading Atypical, the podcast. If you enjoy our work, all we ask is that you leave us a review in your podcast player and share it with your friends. It helps us reach more people, and it's always great to hear from you. Thank you again, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of Atypical, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Atypical, the podcast, a podcast where we look at life from a more atypical perspective. My name's Simon, your host, he, they, and, well, I've said this before and I'll probably say it again, it's just me this week. I know it's been a little while, actually, some 6 or 7 weeks, I think, since we last put out an episode. A mixture of things behind that, autistic burnout, my computer decided to go the way of a Norwegian blue parrot, and as anyone who's probably tried to herd up a group of neurodivergent people in the past knows, it can be somewhat difficult sometimes. This was always my passion project, and it's something that I intend to keep doing for as long as I can. It's nice when I have other people here, because then it's not just me talking into the void, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. I've not really prepared that much, I'm afraid, but what I have got is a few things that I've kind of spotted in and around the media in the last little while, and they sort of gave me some thoughts, and I just kind of wanted to share some of them with you. I suspect some of them will form part of future episodes, but there was a few things that really sort of stuck out to me in the last few weeks. And, I mean, might as well just dive straight in here. You know, I, as some of you know, I work in sort of projects. I'm a project professional, I think, is the term we like to use. And one of the things that I was wondering recently was whether or not the construction industry is a little bit more, well, diverse than perhaps meets the eye at first glance. I work with a lot of people in the construction industry as part of my job, and indeed I have friends who are in there. And so I was quite pleased when I spotted this article at the start of the year with some quite eyebrow-raising stats, actually, from a recent survey by the Association for Project Management. And it turns out that nearly half of construction professionals say that they're neurodivergent. 46%, in fact. They looked and asked and surveyed over 1,000 project professionals across different UK sectors in construction and sort of engineering and so forth, and they asked them about their neurodivergence. And what was really interesting was the construction sector had a higher percentage of self-identified neurodivergent people compared with the overall average, almost half, as opposed to the normal sort of 5 to 15% range, depending on where you are. So putting my hard hat aside for a second, it's obviously not just about labelling yourself. It's about how your employers respond. And reading into this research that was done by the APM, it's beyond impressive. It's that something like 96% of these construction professionals, like I say, who identified themselves as neurodivergent, told their employers about it. And the thing that completely blew me away was that the majority of employers actually made some kind of change to accommodate those needs. Somewhere around 88% of them, in fact, reporting back that their employer had made changes to support them. Now, anyone who's been in and around the sort of diversity inclusion community, well, yeah, that's an astonishing number. But the wonderful thing is, I think it goes to show a certain amount of, I suppose, acceptance that's come along in the last few years and inclusivity in action. But sort of, you know, note of balance here is that despite this positive trend, there are obviously still some barriers that we all have to overcome. Certainly some people within my world of sort of project professionals feel hesitant about disclosing themselves to their bosses. I'm totally open about it to everyone I know, but that's just me. Not everyone has that belief that they'll be supported by their people. I don't know whether that's because they fear judgment or they just simply don't see the point in sharing. But for me, embracing that neurodiversity isn't just about being nice. It's about tapping into those unique strengths and perspectives that we can bring that can benefit an entire team, an entire industry. Adam Bodison, the chief executive of the APM, kind of emphasizes this point quite nicely by talking about the importance of creating a welcoming environment and highlighting how embracing neurodiversity isn't just politically correct, it's about enhancing creativity and problem-solving and overall productivity. One of the people quoted in the article is Jenny McLaughlin, who is a project manager at Heathrow Airport, who has ADHD and dyslexia. And she emphasises that not is it just that every brain is wired differently, but society shouldn't favour one type of wiring over another. She sees neurodiversity as an opportunity, a way to create a more inclusive world where everyone's strengths are valued. So what does this all mean in terms of construction? It does suggest that we're moving in the right direction, certainly the bigger companies. And it suggests that by embracing neurodiversity, companies aren't just ticking a box. They are unlocking that potential, that creation, that fostering of a culture where everyone can thrive. And for those of us who don't fit the traditional mold, maybe it's time to celebrate our uniqueness. After all, in a world where diversity is the rule, being typical might just become a thing of the past. Anyway, whilst I'm on the news, I think we can all agree that it seems like many people around us that we might know experience what I can only describe as symptoms of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity, even if they don't necessarily meet the clinical diagnosis of ADHD, for example. And what's interesting is that these milder sort of traits, if you want to think of it level, ADHD symptoms are essentially on the same spectrum as the clinical disorder, but arguably at the lower end of severity. Now, I was talking about this with my friend and hopefully future guest on this podcast, Alexander, and he decided to send me a link to the Daily Mail, the other day, with the interestingly titled article of "Using your phone for just 2 hours a day may raise the risk of ADHD in adults." Now, once I'd stopped ranting and found someone to read the article for me, because I refuse to engage with that rag, I think I found something a little closer to reality. I'll put the link in the show notes as ever, but the paper they're referring to, the catchily titled "Trait Level Non-Clinical ADHD Symptoms in a Community Sample and Their Association with Technology Addictions," was published in September 2023, so quick off the mark as ever for the tabloids. But it looked at how everyday ADHD traits relate to different kinds of technology addictions, like addiction to the internet or social media, smartphones, online shopping. I'm sure we can all think of times we've been like that. The researchers wanted to try and understand if people prone to inattention or hyperactivity, impulsivity, are more likely to struggle with these kinds of technological addictions. Now, it's only a small group so far they've looked at. They gathered data from 150 adults between 19 and 58 years old from the general community, so it's not just those with an ADHD diagnosis. And they got these participants to go through several really well-validated sort of self-reporting questionnaires, including things like the Adult ADHD Self-Reporting Scale, the Bergen Self-Media Addiction Scale, the Smartphone Addiction Scale, Young's Internet Addiction Test, and the Compulsive Online Shopping Scale. I have to admit, some of these were new to me, and I've been reading up on them, and they do appear to be pretty reasonable ways of sort of assessing people. But what I found fascinating reading through this paper was that the findings show that overall, the more severe someone's composite ADHD symptom score, so we're combining inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, the more likely they were to show higher levels of internet, social media, smartphone, and some types of online shopping addiction. There was a clear positive correlation between ADHD trait severity and risk for technology addictions. That kind of suggests there is a fairly clear link between, well, ADHD and tech addictions as a whole. But the researchers were digging a bit further into the two main symptoms that are dominant within ADHD, that is inattention and hyperactivity impulsivity. And they found that inattention symptoms were moderately associated with addictions to social media, the internet, and online shopping, but that hyperactive or impulsive symptoms were linked to just social media addiction. So using a certain amount of statistical modelling that I have to admit went slightly over my head, and I had to ask a friend to help me out with this, the researchers were able to identify which specific ADHD symptoms were the best predictors of each technology addiction. So breaking this down a bit further, they went into it to find that whilst both inattention and the hyperactivity impulsivity predicted higher risks of social media and smartphone addictions, but for internet addiction, only the inattention symptoms were the predictor. It seems that hyperactivity impulsivity don't really play a big role in internet addiction, which is interesting. Neither inattention nor hyperactivity impulsivity together could predict a higher risk of online shopping addiction when both were considered together. But Inattention when measured alone seems to be the standout. It appears to be the most consistent risk factor across addictions and is the sole predictor of online shopping addiction specifically. So the researchers propose that this could be due to inattention-linked factors like difficulty sustaining focus, executive control deficits, or just simply constantly seeking new stimulation to avoid boredom. I'm pretty sure we all know someone for whom ADHD and shopping feels like a significant overlap. Certainly, sometimes I have to avoid looking at online shops because they'll just sit there in my brain. And it does look like, in general, the study suggests that people with tendencies towards inattention, hyperactivity or impulsivity, even at subclinical levels, may be more vulnerable to developing addictive patterns with technologies like the internet and social media and smartphones. But it does seem that inattention specifically is the standout risk factor for internet overuse. And the researchers, the authors of this paper, they're at pains to point out that most of the previous work in this area has focused on clinical ADHD populations, you know, people who have been diagnosed with ADHD. And this is one of the first studies to properly look at how the milder ADHD-style traits in the general public might predispose them to these technology addictions. And of course, findings like this always need to be interpreted with a certain amount of caution because of the limitations of a smaller sample size. We talked about this in previous episodes on other studies. And there is a certain reliance on convenient sampling methods, cross-sectional study design. It can't prove causation fundamentally, and I will get a scientist on one day to actually explain what all of this stuff means. Anyway, overall, the work does highlight how ADHD-related traits that many people experience could make us more prone to unhealthy overuse of technologies, even without meeting the criteria for a full-blown clinical disorder diagnosis. And people who constantly struggle with concentration issues, for example, may be at particular risk of internet or smartphone addictions. The researchers do argue that clarifying these links between the subclinical ADHD symptoms and technology addictions is really important. From my reading of it, I think it really could help guide prevention and treatment efforts for effectively these modern behavioural addictions, which at the moment kind of lack formal clinical recognition or standardized diagnostic criteria. You know, as technologies keep advancing and integrating into our lives, it really is becoming critical to understand what makes certain individuals more susceptible to developing compulsive or excessive habits around their use. You know, we all know various stories about children who effectively fall into gambling by using loot boxes in games and the way in which lots of technology is almost designed to hold on to people. I think this study is really interesting because it suggests that personality traits like inattentiveness and impulsivity might represent risk factors that are worth looking out for. And I think that if we can learn a bit more, we can build up some kind of recognition for them. I'm not saying necessarily we want something like, you know, going into DSM-5, because we've discussed the issues of that and the medical model in the past, but having a greater understanding and predictor of behaviours and people who are likely to fall into this kind of addictive behaviour, I think is incredibly important. If further research helps us to sort of unpack this psychological mechanism, if you will, that's involved, we could get much better at helping to prevent people from getting into that, stopping these addictions from taking hold and impairing your functioning, your ability to work, to your home life, your relationships. And so whilst this paper is just an initial exploration, I do think these findings have real-world relevance for public health and well-being in our frankly digitally saturated world. It says me on a podcast you were listening to on a digital device, having read a paper online and spent several hours trying to make heads and tails of it. We live in a digital world. If we can avoid the addictions to it, I think that's probably quite helpful, preferably without being beaten for it, which is something I kind of want to finish us off with, is that following our episode on ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, or Autistic Conversion Therapy, as I think I called it, I did spot an article in The New Yorker, and I'll link it again in the show notes as ever. And it's kind of interesting. It's starting to edge towards the weeds of that more heated debate around ABA. And it was interesting to me because it sort of sits at that intersection of misunderstanding about autistic traits and straight out racism in some ways. For anyone who hasn't listened to our episode on it, ABA is basically a system of rewards, sweets, praise, that kind of thing, to encourage desired behaviours and skills in autistic kids, and punishments to discourage the undesirable ones. You can't see me doing air quotes, but there you are. It sounds harmless enough when you put it that way. You know, it's the sort of thing most parents do. But no, really no. This controversy runs deep. The roots of ABA are dark and twisted. You know, we're talking 1960s onwards. Ivor Lovass at the UCLA, who would punish the kids he worked with slapping, shouting, electric shocks, starvation. And that's if they engaged in stuff like stimming, you know, normal things that lots of us do, or just being inattentive. It's really something out of a horror movie. And it's not really a wonder that the neurodiversity campaigners, this podcast, our community, are so vehemently against it, because it's just dehumanizing and abusive. If you want to know more, we did an entire episode on it. You know, content warning already for that. I'm going to do a follow-up one on Ivor Lovass in particular and the book he published, because it's not good, but it's one of those things that I think we need to talk about in order to understand how the community is coming together to fight back and gain agency in these things. Anyway, back to this article, and the sort of the thesis running through it is that when you have parents of autistic kids who struggle with violent outbursts, they injure themselves, or they struggle with basic tasks like getting dressed or using the bathroom independently. For them, ABA might be more than a therapy. It's sold as a lifeline to teach crucial life skills. The mother portrayed in the article, Tiffany Hammond, has an older nonverbal son called Aiden who needs round-the-clock care, and she tried ABA briefly but was basically turned off by the clinic having Aiden repeatedly solve shape puzzles for candy rewards. The line that really stuck out to me was where she was comparing the training to like he's a puppy, because yeah, that sounds like a great way of training people, as if they are small dogs. At the same time, Hammond is all too aware of how differently society treats her black son's autistic behaviours, like stimming versus a white kid. She knows police have been called on them before, just for Aiden being loud and, again air quotes, uncontrolled in public. And so, as ethically murky as ABA sort of compliance training might be, she does wonder if having Aiden learn this kind of masking and being able to contain his behaviours might be a necessity for him to stay safe. And that's a really difficult position for a mother to sit at, is that I can either push my child towards abusive therapy and he might live, or racism on the other side. That's not a position I think anyone wants to be in. And the arguments in this article get even more layered, especially as they start looking at modern, again air quotes, ABA providers, some of whom are autistic themselves, and that's claim that the practice has evolved to be more affirming and focused on cultivating independence rather than the behavioural suppression. You know, no more food rewards or harsh, quiet hands demands. They're just meeting kids where they're at. But then critics would also argue that those providers aren't actually doing ABA at that point. They're just labelling their work like that to get covered by insurance. Hello and welcome to America, where everything is on an insurance process, and I'm so sorry for all my American listeners with that, but healthcare should be a fundamental human right, free at the point of use. Anyway, off that high horse, the whole thing is a bit of a mess, and I'm not even sure where to begin to start pulling this stuff apart. Maybe in a future episode, if I can learn more or find a guest who can explain this to me. But anyway, back to the article. And it seems that at the crux of it all is this sort of fundamental disagreement over whether autism should be treated as a disorder that needs intervention and behavioural modification. Certainly on this podcast, and indeed many of our friends across the community, we say that autism is just a natural human variation. It shouldn't be pathologised. The problem is an unaccommodating society not the autistic individual. As Marianne has explained previously, this is the social model argument. On the flip side, you do have parents and organisations who argue that the autism spectrum oversimplifies a hugely variable condition, which, okay, that's a view I'm partially open to. I'm not wholly sold, however, on their argument about wanting a separate medical diagnosis of profound autism, you know, for people who have higher support needs, or in their language are severely impaired. You know, there are some people who unfortunately may never achieve self-sufficiency and desperately need that kind of evidence-based intervention, preferably something better than ABA. Since doing our episode on it, I've really come to notice that there is a battle being fought by prominent voices on both sides who accuse each other of distorting reality and not truly representing the needs of the most in need autistic people. In the midst of this sort of polarized landscape, families like the Hammonds have to navigate these incredibly difficult choices about what therapies to pursue or avoid for their loved ones. And while the article doesn't offer a nice, neat solution, it does a good job of humanizing it in a way that I think is worth sharing. You know, it might give you that first bit of preparation before diving into the moral quagmire around ABA's past, around the intersection between ableism and racism and ability to access support. This debate is nowhere near being close to being resolved, but it's one that I think we should all be aware of, and if you have the strength, be involved in. Anyway, I feel like I've rambled for a bit, mostly about nothingness. I'm hoping we can get back into a proper rhythm again soon with all of our regular co-hosts back on. Like I said, I'm hoping to get my friend Alexander on again. We're going to cover a whole range of stuff in the media and some of the deeper philosophy around these things. But until then, I hope you all have had a very pleasant week. I wish you a great weekend, and we'll speak to you again soon. Take care now. Bye-bye.